You're listening to the Contemplative Light podcast with your host, Clint Sabon.
Greetings and welcome to the Contemplative Light podcast. I'm your host, Clint Sabon. Contemplative Light provides education and resources in a global effort towards inner transformation through meditation and contemplative prayer. You can find us on Facebook at Contemplative Light, where we've got a very active Facebook community, always posting interesting things daily, or at our website at contemplativelight.org. Different ways you can support the show, help us out. You could write a review in Apple Podcast. You could go to our website at contemplativelight.org and make a donation, which is always good, or just read and share our articles. Take an online class, which are free for a very limited time with the pandemic going on right now. Or buy the new book, Dante's Road, from our executive director, Mark Thomas Shaw, which just won an Illumination Book Award. Congrats, Mark. So my guest today is Amoda Ma. Amoda Ma is a spiritual teacher offering meetings and retreats to support and deepen the living of an awakened life. She has been sharing her teachings since 2012, initially at small gatherings. Today, her teachings are followed by a growing number of seekers worldwide. Amoda brings to her teaching a depth and breadth of understanding of the human journey, born out of her own immersion in the furnace of personal transformation. She's definitely been through it. In 2002, in the depths of existential aloneness, she experienced a profound awakening in which there was a liberation of self from the knot of ego and an ongoing unfoldment into inner silence. After a long period of integration in which all seeking and all methods stopped, she started to speak in public. Her teachings are free of any ideology and are not affiliated with any lineage or tradition. While she's often referred to as a non-dual teacher, she prefers to emphasize the full embracement of the human experience as a path to liberation. Her work continues to evolve in alignment with the real-life concerns of the modern-day seeker of peace and fulfillment in an increasingly chaotic world. And for all those reasons, I highly recommend her most recent book, Embodied Enlightenment, really goes into integrating awakening and living in the world in an awakened state and all the concerns of day-to-day life that a lot of spiritual teachers are kind of afraid or hesitant to address, as she kind of gets into the messiness of human life alongside with contemplative awakening. So her book, Embodied Enlightenment, I'll put a link below. It's been a big help to me. And our conversation had lots of great depth. So hope you enjoy. Hi, Amoda. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Clint. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. Yeah. It's a real honor to have you on and, familiar with your material and, just really have a lot of things I'm really curious about talking about. But first and foremost, how are you doing with the situation, and how is everything sitting with you and the current world situation we're in?
Well, personally, I'm very well, thank you. On a more collective level, I've been speaking with many people about the pandemic of fear, which seems to be the primary pandemic. And I'm not focusing either personally or speaking to people in my community. I'm not focusing on the causes of the virus, the reasons for the virus, but rather what we can do to deepen into who we really are beyond the fear that seems to be the primary pandemic. So whatever the causes are and whatever the reasons and wherever the virus has come from and whatever story we might focus on, whichever position or opinion we may take up, depending on our background and our viewpoint and so on, there seems to be no conclusive evidence for what is really going on the surface level. And like I said, personally and in my role as a you know, spiritual teacher, that's not where my focus is. My focus is on what is going on a deeper level. What is the what is being called for during these times? I mean, it could be anything, whether it's a virus or some other calamity or crisis. It's still going to be the same deeper calling, the same deeper invitation. How can we be spiritually resilient during times of crisis? How can we deepen into who we really are beneath the surface of what's going on? Because that's always the invitation of life. It's just intensified right now. It's amplified. So what a perfect opportunity, certainly for those who have a background in spiritual practice, have been on a spiritual path for many years. This is kind of where the spiritual rubber hits the reality road. This is where we're, I call it tested, and I don't mean there's somebody or some being out there testing us, but life itself is calling us to see how deeply rooted we are in presence and in openness, because that's the only thing that really matters. What is more essential than the surface drama, the surface fear? And of course, that means walking through the doorway, or, you know, having a conversation that starts with the surface. Obviously, a lot of people are in panic, a lot of people are in fear, and so on. So it's not to avoid that, it's not to belittle that. We're being called to be kind and tender towards the many feelings that are arising for each of us in different ways, feelings of despair or depression or anxiety or uncertainty. For some, it's a sense of anticipation for the new, a sense of potential, maybe heartbreak in some ways for what is happening on a global level, for what is so uncertain. We don't have a sure footing, not that we ever did, but here it is again, intensified and amplified. So it's not to belittle those feelings, but to start there and then to go deeper than that, because each of us has the power and the innate capacity to stand, if you like, as presence and as openness in the face of uncertainty, in the face of the unknown, in the face of what seems on the surface to be a crisis, a calamity. So it's a very intense spiritual time, which hasn't got anything to do with transcending our world, but about really living our deepest spiritual truth. We might call it a spiritual truth. I tend these days to not divide our experience into spiritual or unspiritual. It's a deep existential truth, to root ourselves in our true nature.
Yeah, you know, as far as going deeper in all of this, one of the things I really appreciate about your work is that I've heard you talk about is not attaching to our own narrative and our own story. And obviously this is a time where there's a collective story. There's lots of different collective stories. And it's also a time where I imagine a lot of us are more prone to slip into mulling over our personal story and telling a story about ourselves, whether it's a projection of what will happen or, you know, a dwelling on the past, or it's just that problem of attaching to a narrative or our own narrative and part of, you know, staying in presence is not attaching to that and transcending that. I suppose I was wondering if you could kind of just address that whole issue as far as this goes, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yes. To all of that. My primary teaching and primary in non-dual teachings is the seeing beyond the stories, seeing beyond the thought story, which wraps itself around our sensing and perceiving of our experience. And I speak a lot about this. I call it narratives rather than stories, although I mean the same thing. The narratives are usually, this shouldn't be happening. This shouldn't be happening to me. This is wrong. Or following that will be a whole load of narratives about what might happen. And if that happens, then what will happen to me? And all these narratives really revolve around the me. Yeah, it's my survival that's threatened. It's my life that's threatened. It's my preferences and pleasures and successes and gains that are going to be threatened. It's my loss. It's my disaster. It's my calamity. So it's all about me, either on the negative side or the positive side. And it's these narratives that we wrap around our experience, our immediate experience of life, our sensing, our perceiving, and so on, that create a separation between the I that perceives, the self that perceives, that is sensing, that is experiencing, and reality itself. So it's never really reality that we're experiencing, but an imagination, the imagination of my future. And so we could also call this a lack of presence, not living in the present. And very often this idea or this concept of living in the present implies for some people a kind of la-la land, that if I live in the present, I'm not, you know, attending to my life and the future and taking care. But of course, when you deepen into your own awakening or one's own spiritual practice, you realize that that's not what living in the present is. Better than saying living in the present, it's just presence, living as presence. Yeah, living as presence means that you are not wrapping a narrative around reality. You're just really sensing it, really tasting the texture of this experience as it unfolds within you. And from that, you're not reacting from the mind that wants to run ahead and protect itself or run away from something it's scared of or create a kind of safety net in its imagination about how life should be. So instead of running away in the mind, in the imaginings, one is fully living as presence itself. It's a very open and naked relationship with life. And contrary to what the mind, the conventional mind, might think will happen in that, in the space of presence and openness, you're informed by a deeper intelligence than the mind that thinks it can control life, that it can control its future. So we're living as presence, and from that presence there's a responsiveness rather than a reactiveness. And that brings a great aliveness, a great intelligence, more possibilities that flow from that place.
Yeah, that's interesting you say about control, because I do think part of this is making the illusion of control no longer a luxury for a lot of us. But I guess in a sense it's always been an illusion. You know, we didn't really have control before. It's just a little more palpable now.
Yes, yes, exactly. We've never had control. We can't control our lives. We can't control death. Death is always inevitable. It's just not often acknowledged or faced. Each one of us is going to die at some point, but we don't consciously meet that death. And when I say consciously, I don't mean at the last minute. I mean now, in this moment, in this moment, in this moment. To consciously meet death is to simply allow the ego self, yeah, the self that tries to control life, to die in this moment, to die in this moment. And so here we have that opportunity for those who have been on a spiritual path and have got a background of some kind of spiritual practice. Here it is. Here is that an opportunity to really live that truth and not just practice it, you know, for 20 minutes a day or whatever it is, and then forget about it. But to really live that truth. And for those who have less of a background in this, if you like, well, again, here is the opportunity. We don't have to have a background in it. It obviously that helps, but it's sort of in our faces now. Yeah, it's right up close to us and intimate that we have no control. But the scrambling around, or what I call the flapping around on the surface, which is the tendency of the ego mind, and that creates the drama, and that creates the panic, and that creates the anxiety, and that creates the, if you like, the division or the war. You know, this is my opinion, and I'm going to stick to it, and that's against your opinion, which I think is wrong, or whatever it might be. That kind of toing and froing on the surface, where the ego mind likes to take a position of certainty. It thinks it knows what the answer is. It thinks it knows what's going on. It thinks it knows what's going to happen to me if this happens or this doesn't happen. All of that just creates the drama and adds to the pandemic of fear, and serves nothing but to create a kind of internal and possibly external division or war. Yeah, we're warring with ourselves. We're warring with life. There's only one solution to that, and that's to end the war. End the war within.
Yeah. Yeah, and is that, you know, bringing up death like that, is that ending of the war, or the ending, let me put it this way, is the fear of death really just the fear of ego death?
Ultimately, yes, yes. It's the end. Death is not just the death of the physical form, even when it is the death of the physical form, it really is the death of the psychological form, because without the psychological form, the physical form is nothing but a shell. So it's the death of me. It's the death of who I think I am. It's the death of my identity. And that's really what we're afraid of.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious because you talk in your book and in your works about, an ego death, a complete annihilation of your ego and an ego death that happened with you. And in that kind of dark night, did you feel like you were going to physically die while that was happening? Was like physical, the possibility of physical death and the ego death that was happening kind of side by side with that?
That's a good question. It was definitely experienced as the fear of death. Yeah, the fear of death arose. The fear of the end of me. Now, it didn't matter whether the body would die or not. I mean, associated with the death of me as an entity of self, yeah, a psychological me, inevitably that's linked with the death of the body. But when faced with that death, the psychological death, the death of ego, the death of the me self, the me identity, one's focus is not on the body, because there is at the same time an awareness that nothing is actually happening to the body. Uh-huh. My sense is that one would only be afraid of the end of the body if there was an attack on the body, either through illness or physical attack, where the body, but it's not the body's end that we're fearing, it's the pain. Yeah, it's the pain in that.
Sure.
Really what we're meeting, even at the end of our physical lives, is the end of me as an ego self, as an identity. That's all we're really meeting. And it's that fear that we're afraid of. Obviously, at the end of physical life, there's also an awareness that the body's going to stop functioning. So they're kind of intertwined. But in awakening out of ego self, there's an awareness that nothing's happening to the body. So there isn't a focus on that. So that's not where the fear is. The fear is almost more purely focused on the end of me as an identity. But I would say it's the same.
Sure.
It's the same terror that arises, because you're entering the unknown. It's an abyss of unknownness.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's what I was kind of getting at. And I'm also curious, kind of on a similar note, as far as, awakening out of ego and releasing ego. One issue that I'm curious to hear more about is trauma. I've heard you say, on your website, you had an article I really liked where you were basically saying, some people think they need to heal trauma first before they go deeper into non-duality. And some people want to go deeper into non-duality because it makes it easier to heal or transcend trauma. And it does seem like trauma is kind of right on the cusp of maybe a final layer or something. And I'm just wondering, like, when do we let go of it completely and not identify with it, because it is caught up in a narrative? And when do we need to pay attention to it and go deeper into it in a more psychological human way?
There's no direct or definitive answer to that, because it's a very individual journey. For some, the belief that I have to heal all trauma before I can awaken is a great impediment to the freedom that is already here and available, whatever our background, whatever our history, however much trauma we've experienced or been subject to. that freedom is always available to us. So the belief that I have to heal all trauma in order to know my true nature as freedom, that in itself has to be examined, or at least held up as a possible narrative that is not actually true. In my case, I had a story, a narrative that I had to be, yes, I had to be perfect. I had to perfect myself. It's the same thing. I suffered a lot of trauma in my childhood, and I spent many years working on it, processing emotions that were previously suppressed, and so on, you know, psychologically and, you know, through psychotherapy and many other modalities. And still, you know, much of that unraveled certain emotional blocks, let's say, and was very helpful. But still, I carried this idea that I wasn't perfect enough, that I needed to work on myself and I needed to be stronger or be more powerful or have more self-esteem or more self-worth or something. And this went on for many years. And so for me, there came a point where just being where I am, not in a kind of resigned way, but just allowing life to inform me without having to strive for perfection, that was a huge surrender of the need to fix myself. And that opened a certain doorway that led to another sort of phase, which then led to awakening. Well, I don't know if it led to it, but it certainly opened the doorway to a deepening. So I think for many people, it is important to not hold tightly as if it was the truth that I have to heal my trauma before I can awaken. On the other hand, there is an intelligent relationship that we can have between our history and our present capacity to be present, to be open, to be fully here, and meet reality as it is. And sometimes that requires, very often that requires some work on the self, yeah, to at least, it certainly requires us to meet what hadn't been previously met, which is what trauma is. It's an avoidance of the, sort of kind of escape from the powerlessness and helplessness, the vulnerability of whatever happened in the past, of being small as a child or whatever the situation was. It's that helplessness and vulnerability that we avoid, and therefore certain feelings are not met. They're avoided or suppressed. And that's what trauma is. So we have to be able to somehow or other, either with support through trauma work or trauma counseling or body work or whatever it is, or simply by our willingness, and it can happen either way or both ways, to fully be here in the midst of the trigger that happens when trauma replays itself now, either through a relationship or just our relationship with life in various ways, to be able to sit with that, to meet it, and to be vulnerable in that means to be present in it. And that presence, it's the presence that heals it. Because in presence, we realize that feelings cannot kill us.
Yeah. I like how you say, when you talk about shame in another piece on your website, you say the antidote for shame is to welcome shame. You know, it's kind of like welcoming everything is being fully present.
Yes, absolutely. And certainly that was my path. Like I say, I had a lot of many years of personal work, psycho-spiritual modalities of all sorts. So I do think that there is a kind of tilling of the soil that happens, you know, and I was very shut down. So certainly that work needed to happen. But the real openings started to happen when I simply decided, if you like, or it was decided for me somehow, to welcome everything. Whatever experience is here, whatever feeling is here, however life flows, whether I like it or don't like it, whether I feel pain or pleasure, whether I'm high or low, whether I feel spiritual or unspiritual, it was really the path of surrender to me, for me. And you know, that surrender is just welcoming everything. And the more I deepened into that and the more I embraced that, not as an intellectual idea, but as a lived experience, and life brought many ups and downs, that allowed the deeper surrender to happen, which was the surrender of ego self.
Sure. And I think that, you know, another thing I'm curious about is that staying presence and welcoming everything in the midst of day-to-day life, because, you know, I think there's a tendency of people to want to somehow almost have like a silent retreat or to step back from life in order to be able to be fully present. But to be fully present to everything internally in the midst of being present to external day-to-day life concerns, I think a lot of us get tripped up there. I was wondering if you could kind of speak to that, because you're it's like you got to be present to the external as well as the internal, and obviously I guess ultimately those two are the same, but I guess I'm just thinking more of like day-to-day activities and versus the inner kind of emotional kinesthetic and awareness state.
Yes, let's start with the end part of your dialogue, which is the external and the internal are one and the same. Whatever we experience in relationship to the events of our lives, the happenings of our lives, the seeming occurrences, which can be, you know, major events or the very ordinary, mundane, everyday occurrences of life, which is what life is. It's an ongoing occurrence. There's only the I, the self, that is experiencing that. There's nothing independent of that. So whether it's personal, collective, whether it's a major event or just the everyday ongoingness of whatever's happening or whatever is being experienced, it's all experienced by the self. And so the world is in us. The world that we experience is literally in me. Literally in my consciousness. It can't be outside of my consciousness. So, yes, ultimately it's they're one and the same. Having said that, we come to that realization at some point as we deepen into presence, as we soften into or relax into openness, or relax into ourselves as openness, we either consciously or subconsciously start to experience the world in me. There's nothing outside of me as such. I mean, that's quite a radical shift of perception. It either happens gradually or it happens suddenly. But going back to the beginning of your dialogue, we do the greatest transformation of consciousness, the greatest opportunity for true freedom from the suffering of ego narratives is to live as presence in the everyday world. And in that sense, we don't need to go on spiritual retreat, although that's helpful. But the real work happens in everyday life. Awakening, if that is one's motivation, if you like, or desire, or deep longing, doesn't necessarily have to be a one-time big explosion or, you know, big happening that happens because you've been spiritual. It can unfold gradually as you live and deepen into presence here and here and here in this ordinary everyday life. I mean, awakening is actually nothing more than our ordinary state of consciousness. If we can meet reality without a narrative, which is a huge shift of the way of seeing things or being with things, but if we could live without the constant narratives, then we'd know who we are. We'd live as we are, as our natural state of openness. That's awakening.
Yeah, you know, and you've mentioned too that with some people in various stages of awakening that don't do what you just said completely, with some people that are in various stages of awakening or even awakened teachers, there can be an avoidance of relationship. I was wondering if you could talk about that, and why do you think sometimes that happens with awakened people or people in an awakening process?
There seems to be a tendency, and particularly because spiritual teachings, even non-dual teachings, have been passed down through a mostly patriarchal lineage. The invitation to, or the opportunity for that awakened consciousness to flow into our intimate relationships hasn't been part of that picture. Traditionally, intimate relationships are a distraction from the spiritual path. So that historical type of spiritual path, which avoids the intimacy or the mess of human relationships, that's no longer relevant, and yet it still pervades some of our beliefs around awakening or enlightenment and so on. And I feel that we live in very different times now, and the understanding or the need or the purpose of awakening is evolving, and it's much more holistic now. And to have an awakened experience does not necessarily mean that anything has really transformed in the realm of you know, human relationships, and that's vital, because without that, then awakened consciousness doesn't have a chance to filter into the heart. So it's not just about illuminated mind, it's also about illuminated heart. And even though many traditional teachings do talk about the heart, like Buddhist teachings, when it comes to actually be lived, that's not very often the case. Now, I'm making a generalization there, but there is that tendency, because when it descends into the heart, that doesn't mean just being compassionate to the world. It means in the very vulnerable space. It's where we are most vulnerable is to another, to the one that we're closest to, and the illuminated mind or the enlightened mind, if that's held onto as the ultimate goal of awakening or enlightenment, then the vulnerability that is felt in intimate relationships where we're most triggered, where a deeper lived kindness and tenderness and bowing down of the ego is called for, it can't filter into the heart. So then you get this split of even certain teachers or individuals who are very awakened on a mind level and have a deep or profound or wide non-dual realization. And then in intimate relationships or sort of behind the scenes, that's not really lived. And you may find, well, we see that with the scandals that emerge in spiritual communities and so on. So, and that happens on a gross level when we see that in a well-known spiritual community, a tradition, and it shocks everyone in the community. And we see it in more subtle levels with ordinary awakened individuals or individuals who've had an awakening experience, and yet there's this sort of cutoff around the heart. And yeah, so I talk a lot about the embodiment of awakening, which is the full living that truth in all relationships, in all interactions. Doesn't mean that we're perfect, we don't become perfect individuals, but it does mean that we are willing to live as that presence and as that openness in the very mess of our human experience.
Sure. And you know, I mean, I think that seems to be very common with a lot of people and that get into this and, you know, are in various stages, is there's, an openness on kind of a mind level or a consciousness level, but on a heart and emotional level, not only is it not lived like, you know, the examples you kind of described, but there's still trauma, there's still shame, there's still parts of the ego still hanging on. I mean, do you think that can be a common kind of trap where there's kind of an opening into the formless, and then there's still kind of traumatized and shamed and contorted parts of the ego still kind of hanging on, like it hadn't been fully subsumed and into the fire of consciousness?
Yes, absolutely. And also there's also a tendency when mind is awakened to reform a subtle ego identity around that, and that creates an arrogance. Because what happens, we've spoken a lot here about the end of ego, yeah, the death of ego. But we also have to say that, I need to say that even though there is an ego death that happens in awakening, there has to be, the identity of self dies, there is also a reforming of ego that has to inevitably take place. It's not the same ego. It's not the ego as a tight knot of concepts and ideas and structures and beliefs about who I am. That dissolves. if there's to be true awakening, but an ego self has to reform. In other words, there has to be a sense of I that reforms itself. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to operate as in the three-dimensional earthly reality. So it's not the end of ego, it's the evolution of ego, perhaps is a better word, I sometimes say it's an awakened ego. It's just not the same. It hasn't got the same tight structure. So there is a self that reforms itself in order for us to continue living as human beings after awakening. But as it reforms, if there are areas of self that haven't been consumed in that fire of awakening, then it'll stick to those. And the most common one is to stick to a certain arrogance of mind that believes itself to have found the ultimate state of awakening. And that then prevents the full embodiment of awakening. So there has to be an ongoing surrender. And that ongoing surrender of self can only really be invited through the purification that happens in relationship to the world, in relationship to the people that we're close to, in relationship to our work, in relationship, and usually an intimate relationship is the most potent purifying process. That's where it really gets tested, if you like.
Sure, yeah, because I guess if your ego had reformed and had clung to a sense of arrogance, and ego reforming around this awakened state, an intimate relationship might expose that arrogance very quickly.
Absolutely, it'll expose the arrogance. It'll expose the vulnerability. It'll expose everything that hasn't been previously exposed, that cannot be exposed just in the awakened mind. It cannot be exposed just in a non-dual realization. It has to be in the kind of nitty-gritty of a day-to-day relationship. Where are we telling the truth? Where are we listening to the truth? Are we listening, truly listening as openness? Are we relating from a place of need? Because need seems to be embedded in intimate relationship. Can we truly meet the other without need, without expectation, without agenda? And all these things still continue after awakening.
Sure, but it does sound like you're saying there is a point in this whole process where the reformed ego, so to speak, in the awakened context, that everything can slip into an equanimity and a balance that is pretty constant, pretty steady all the time, if that makes sense.
Would you just say that again, Clint?
Well, I mean, we were talking about, an ego death, and then after that, there is a reforming of the ego, and we were talking about how sometimes there's things that still need to get worked out, and I was just kind of jumping ahead to some sort of quote unquote end point, not that it ever ends, but saying that there's something close to that where there is kind of a balance, in an equanimity of it all.
Yes. There is a place or a space, certainly the possibility, and so it has been in my direct experience, that if And usually if surrender has been the primary flow, the primary path, if you like, and not just a haphazard, unexpected, spontaneous awakening without any, if you like, experience of surrender of self before that. But if surrender is sort of embedded in you, it's a sort of a deep calling or a deep understanding, if you like, or a deep invitation that is alive in you, then even when the ego self, or the I self, it's better to say, it's more accurate, the I self reforms itself after awakening, after the initial ego demolition, the I self reforms itself. If surrender has been your deepest calling, then that I self will continue to be in service, if you like, to awakened consciousness. And then it's as if the floodgates are open and the light of that awakened consciousness can then flow into the lived, embodied experience in everyday life. And certainly that was my experience. Still, there's an ongoing purification, but it's much more subtle.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you know, to go back and I don't know if you don't want to talk about any of this, it's okay, but because it's probably going back in time for you, but it might help some of our listeners. I was curious if you could talk about any of the modalities or practices or you know, psychological work you did, and any you can note or remember that were helpful in this process, even if it was many years ago for you.
I think there are two issues there. One is remembering them all. It's almost like the past tends to be somewhat erased, although I could dig into it. And secondly, I've found that speaking from my experience and using that to recommend to others hasn't necessarily been helpful. I mean, I've done everything from it's a long time ago, so things have changed as well. Things have progressed. I did many things. I mean, from meditation, Zen meditation, Buddhist meditation, right through to cathartic emotional work, primal therapy, psychosynthesis, shamanic work, right, ritual work, ceremonial work, ecstatic movement, rebirthing. And I was an experienced rebirther myself. Certainly that was superbly helpful because it works with the whole body, mind, emotional system. Really just anything and everything to get me into the body here and now, feeling. Ultimately, this is what it's going to boil down to. Can you feel your feelings? I don't mean being emotional. I don't mean just dumping your emotions and expressing them and screaming and shouting, although that can be part of the process. I just mean feeling your feelings. If you can feel your feelings here and now without creating a narrative about them, which is the narrative of poor me, I was a victim, it shouldn't have happened to me, I don't want to be feeling this, or I'm too frightened to feel that, or it was his fault or her fault or my fault. If you can just feel your feelings without a narrative, that's it. You're here right now.
Yeah, because I guess the narrative is what blocks the feeling flow, basically.
Yes. Yes.
That's the inhibition.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if we're to summarize what is helpful, and, you know, either from my experience and also from my experience as a therapist and as a counselor and as a rebirther and body worker and ecstatic mover and shaker and all of that, that would be it. do anything and everything that supports you to feel what you're feeling right now, without creating a narrative about it. That's it, you're present. And if we can be present, yeah. then we can deepen into that presence. And that's a much more fundamental and, path, if you like, it creates a foundation for awakening. If we focus on awakening without the foundation, which is the capacity to feel what is here now, without avoidance, without suppression, without judgment, if we can really feel it, which means what is conventionally called getting into your body, being in your body. I mean, you're not really being in your body. Your being isn't attached to the body, and you're not contained by the body, but that's the expression we use, is just to be here and feel what is felt, which is through the gateway of the senses, let's say, then that's the foundation for any true awakening. So that addresses the whole problem of spiritual bypassing, which is so common, which is what we've touched on. You know, the idea that you can become perfectly enlightened or perfectly awakened without having dealt with the traumas, the obstructions, the contractions, the avoidances of the human experience.
Yeah, that's really good. I really like that. You just kind of boil down all psychological work, feel everything fully without a narrative. There's the history of psychology right
that's
there.
That's right.
That was nice. So, yeah. Well, I'm curious what you are hearing, or if you're hearing anything from your students or your fans or your readers, et cetera, during this time, during the past month, if there's anything you can share from maybe their experience or their concerns and things you've said or done to help them.
Well, I think this goes back to, again, the beginning of our conversation here. There's sort of almost two things going on. One is, how can we deal with the fear that arises, the anxiety, and those kind of questions that come to me through my dialogues and inquiries with people in my community or participants at my events, which are all online now, of course. Those kind of questions is, about how do I deal with this fear? How do I deal with this anxiety and so on? Then that's the invitation of presence. So then we go into that, the presence without the narratives and so on. And so that's that kind of conversation that is very helpful and supportive. Meeting life in the unknown, or meeting life from the unknown, is also seems to be a very supportive conversation during these times. What does that mean? And is it, how can I do that? And I think most of all, people just want to be reminded, when people are isolated, that's so easy to fall back into the mind and its narratives. So what they're getting through interactions, say with my teaching and what I have to offer during these times, is a reminder that we're in this together. There isn't a single human being that isn't experiencing uncertainty and unknownness, and to be reminded of that, and then to be reminded of the opportunity that is available here. It gives such a sense of belonging
and such a sense of possibility that in the face of the other stuff that we hear in the world, the news and all of that, the other kind of information is kind of the opposite of that. And it's not an we're being told how terrible it is and how frightening it is and how chaotic it is and how we should be scared and how we should, protect ourselves. I don't mean protect ourselves just physically, but in ways that are divisive rather than unitive. And so that's what's really being offered here. The opportunity, the reminder, and the deepest invitation of our times. As I like to say, we are made for these times. I started saying I am made for these times because I've lived in the unknown or from the unknown both in my childhood and right through my adult years in ways that were extremely challenging. But I've also lived from the unknown, in the unknown, as the unknown, in my awakening and the living of that awakening. So in that sense, I feel I am made for these times and I have something to offer in that. But I've changed that recently to say we are made for these times. Each of us is made for these times. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here and now. So what are we going to do? Roll over and be a victim? That doesn't help anything. It doesn't help us as individuals, and it doesn't help the world, humanity collectively. So here it is. We are made for these times, and there is not a single one of us that cannot rise to the occasion.
Yeah, sure. And the unknown is living without a narrative. If the narrative is the known, the unknown is no narrative.
No narrative.
So here we are. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on. This has been really great and such an honor talking to you and getting to hear from you. I know your insight into all of this is going to be very helpful for people. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for the depth of the depth and flow of the conversation, which I've really enjoyed.
Oh, good. Good. Yes, I've enjoyed it too. So stay on, I guess, after I stop the recording, but it's been great having you, and you have a website and a YouTube page where people can find you.
Yes, my website, amodamaa.com. Yeah, so that's amodamaa.com. And my YouTube channel is updated mostly with a weekly video, as much as we can do, and those videos seem to be very helpful to people. So yes.
Okay. Yep. And I'll put a link below to all of that. And thanks again, Amoda.
Okay. Thank you.